Welcome. This is an audio recording of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. The Council is a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to engaging the public in an exploration of global issues and foreign affairs, and we produce over 80 public events each year. To learn more about us or to become a member, visit dfwworld.org. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Thank you very much, Talmadge. I really appreciate that. And to Pat, my old friend from Aspen, thank you for doing this and bringing us here. To the Questrums and everybody else I know from Aspen, it's great to be back in Dallas and great to be at the World Affairs Council, a group that's needed now more than ever as we face a great new global struggle. I know I'm supposed to talk about Einstein, but first I will say something that Talmadge said, which is this is a type of group that Ben Franklin not only would have loved, he would have probably founded it. He loved founding discussion groups in which people who sincerely care about world affairs get together in a creative way to find solutions. But it's also an earlier book I wrote a long time ago called The Wise Men, which was about a group of people, three Democrats, three Republicans, who all happened to be very close friends, who at the beginning of the Cold War were very creative in the way they approached world affairs. They realized we were facing a very bad new global struggle against the spread of Soviet communism, and we had to be creative in how we were going to tackle that twilight struggle. And they created things like NATO, NSC 68, which was the military doctrine, the World Bank, the Marshall Plan, and the doctrines that explain what we were going to do. And I fear that our generation, my generation, has not been quite as creative because we are facing a very similar global struggle, a new long twilight struggle that we're passing on to the next generation, that of global terrorism. And I wish we could be as creative in coming up with the Marshall Plans, the World Banks, the NATO alliances, the military alliances we're going to need to do this. And it's World Affairs Councils around the country where you see the ideas filtering up. And I just hope that we will do for our children what our father's generation did when they faced the struggle against communism. And it really does come down to the issue of creativity. And that's what I'm going to talk about today, because one of the things that surprised me most about Einstein was not his intelligence and not his knowledge, but his creativity. As he has said over and over again, imagination is more important than knowledge. And he was not the most knowledgeable, or for that matter, possibly not even the most intelligent of the physicists in the, around 1905 when he was only a patent clerk. There are people like Max Planck around. But he was the most imaginative and most creative. And that's what we need in this country today, is to spur a sense of imagination, a sense of creativity in the fields of science and world affairs and anything else. The good news for those of you who are parents here like myself is that Einstein was no Einstein when he was a kid. He was really slow in learning how to talk. They dubbed him the dopey one in the family, and they even consulted a doctor because of his slow verbal learning ability. Also, he was very rebellious, causing one headmaster to kick him out of school, another to amuse us by saying, "This Einstein will never amount to much." But I do think it was that slow verbal learning ability that caused him to be so creative. It was one of the causes. First of all, it caused him to think in pictures. He did thought experiments. He was able to visualize things instead of thinking in words. And it's what you and I call daydreaming, but he gets to call them thought experiments, where he's looking at underlying things. Also, it caused him to marvel at things you and I find mundane or ordinary. For example, his dad gives him a compass at age 5. And he sits there for nights on end, he says, with chills as he looks at the compass and tries to visualize an underlying force field. What is a magnetic field? How does it really work? Why does the needle keep pointing north? Now, you and I can probably remember getting a compass when we were kids. And we go, wow, and we go outside and it points north. And we say, wow, that's really cool. And then about 3 minutes later, we're on to something else, you know, a dead snail or whatever we see next. But Einstein was focused on visualizing and wondering about things that most people find ordinary. For example, he says, I was so slow in learning that I started wondering about why time passes. What causes time to pass? What is time? You know, after every kid had quit wondering about such things. And also that rebelliousness, that also adds to his creativity. It causes him to question every premise and every assumption. One of the things that most people think about Einstein does, that happens to be untrue, unfortunately, is that he flunked math as a kid. I always hoped that that would be true, you know. You kind of... If you Google Einstein failed math, you get about 60,000 websites that say, as everybody knows, Einstein failed math as a kid, so maybe there's hope for me. Well, no, he didn't fail math. In fact, the reason he didn't fail math is because he could visualize it. And he understood that an equation is just the good Lord's brushstroke for something underlying physical reality. I was helping my daughter with her math homework a few weeks ago. She's a junior in high school, and she had gotten some equations wrong on her homework. She had multiplied it and got. I said, "Look at the equation. You should just look at it and tell it swoops upward like that." You know, and she says, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, it's just a brushstroke for something in reality. It's got to slope upward. Look at it. It has a y squared and, you know, x cubed in it and stuff." She said, "Oh, they don't teach us to look at things that way." Well, that's the only thing I do hope we can come from Einstein, is that math and science are creative endeavors. We should picture them. We should see the underlying reality. In fact, Einstein, when he was 16... being slightly smarter than my daughter, at least in math, he's looking at Maxwell's equations, which, as you all know, define a light wave or electromagnetic wave. And one thing about Maxwell's equations is they say that the light wave always has to travel at a constant speed, 186,000 miles per second. No matter how your frame of reference is, how you look at it, the light wave is always traveling at that speed. And Einstein says, well, what if I catch up with it? Couldn't I ride alongside the wave? And then it would be stationary next to me. But Maxwell's equations don't allow for that. And he said, I walked around for days on end in high anxiety about this conflict with my palms sweating. And it caused me to think of all the things that were causing my palms to sweat at age 16. And they weren't Maxwell's equations. But that's why he's Einstein and we're not. He, you know, he's such a rebellious kid. He basically gets eased out of the gymnasium school and the high school in Germany. And he runs away, like my friend Benjamin Franklin, runs away as a teenager, runs away to Switzerland, Italy, and then Switzerland. And he applies to get into what is basically the second best college in Zurich, the Zurich Polytech. And he doesn't get in. Now, as somebody with a kid about to apply to college, I really wanted to figure out who was the admissions director of the Zurich Polytech that rejected Albert Einstein. But to his credit, Einstein does get in on his second go-around, becomes a student at the Zurich Polytech, but is able to tick off all of his major professors there because of his challenging of authority. Heinrich Weber, the physics professor at the Zurich Polytech, is so old-fashioned, he doesn't even teach Maxwell's equations. So when Einstein describes the light wave question, he says, don't worry about it. Maxwell's just a new theory or something. Einstein is so frustrated, he quits calling him Herr Professor and starts calling him Herr Weber, which Weber considers an insult, and so Weber has nothing to do with Einstein. Minkowski is the math professor. Einstein doesn't quite realize how important math is to formulating theories, so he skips half the classes and gets his friend Marcel Grossman to take notes for him. So Minkowski's report on Einstein, wonderful if you see it in the archives, says that Einstein is a lazy dog. And oh, that was good. And then there's Pernay, the lab instructor. Einstein was never very good as an experimentalist, which is why he had to become a theorist, you know, the types. And so he goes into the lab class for one of the big experiments, looks at the lab notes he's supposed to follow, crumples them up, throws it away, tries to do it his own way, and blows up the equipment. So he's put on academic probation by Pernay, which means that Einstein is the only graduate of the 1900 class of the Zurich Polytech in physics and math who cannot get an academic job, who's not offered a junior professorship, not offered a teaching assistantship, a doctoral fellowship, anything. He starts applying for jobs to teach high school math and physics, turned down for 17 high school teaching jobs after he graduates from the Zurich Polytech. So he's basically unemployed for 2 years, wandering around, sort of bohemian existence, until finally that guy who took notes for him in math class, Marcel Grossman, pulls some family strings and gets Albert Einstein a job as a third-class examiner in the Swiss Patent Office in Bern. Third class because he didn't have a doctorate, so he couldn't be a second or first class examiner. The lowest rung of patent clerk, sitting on a stool working 6 days a week at the patent office. But lest we feel sorry for him, once again, I think you see his creativity, his ability to visualize things happening because he's working at the patent office. And trust me, he would not have been a good junior professor. He would not have been a good acolyte in the academy trying to please a senior professor and stuff. So there he is in the patent office, and he's got a boss who says, question every premise of every patent application in front of you. Challenge every assumption. And he's out there, right outside of his office is the great Bern Swiss clock tower. Some of you may have seen an 11th century clock tower. And the trains come right underneath it into the station. And most of the patent applications he gets, 70 patent applications between 1902 and 1905, deal with synchronizing clocks. Because Switzerland had just gone on standard time zones. And the Swiss, unlike Texans, for example, are rather obsessive and neurotic, and they really want to synchronize clocks, and they want to make sure that when it strikes 7 in Bern, it'll strike 7 at that exact instant in Zurich. And the one thing that these patent applications have in common is that you have to send a signal between the two clocks to synchronize them. And, of course, the signal travels at the speed of light, whether it's a light signal, a radio signal, an electric signal. So there he is watching the trains going in and out of the station, looking at these patent applications, questioning every premise, and still wondering, can I catch up with the light wave, the experiment he did in his head when he was 16. And he's trying to figure out what all of Europe is trying to figure out, all the great physicists are trying to figure out, this paradox that is hit with Maxwell's equation. Michelson-Morley experiments show no matter what you do, the light wave, no matter how fast you're traveling towards the sun, away from the sun, the light waves always travel at the constant speed. So then Einstein finally tells his best friend, Michele Besso, who he's gotten a job at the patent office, I give up. I can't do it. I'm giving up on that problem. And then the next weekend, he's walking with Besso, and he says, I've got it. I figured it out. And he won't tell Besso what it is, but the next day he explains it to him when they get to work. He says, it all depends on how you define what is simultaneous. Now, you and I don't sit there worrying about how do you define what's simultaneous, like the compass needle. We think, hey, it means it happens at the same time. But for Einstein, the patent examiner, he's saying, no, if something's simultaneous, you have to have an operational definition of it. And it means, for example, two very distant events happening, somebody standing halfway in between would see the light from both events at the exact moment and would say they're simultaneous. So he says to Besso, imagine lightning striking both ends of a very fast-moving, very long train. It's a thought experiment again, creative, imagination. He says, suppose they strike both ends of the train. Suppose somebody on the platform sees the lightning strikes at the exact same moment, the light coming from, and he says they're simultaneous. Now imagine there's a woman on the train. She's traveling real fast. In that nanosecond that it takes the light to travel, she's a little bit closer to the front. She's moved ahead. She says they're not simultaneous. So for somebody in different people in different states of motion will have a different definition of what is simultaneous. And so it just means time is different depending on your state of motion. And he does it, he draws it, does the thought experiment, writes it up as a paper and stuff, and it answers his light wave question. He says, no matter how fast you travel, you can try to catch up with that light wave, it'll always travel at the same speed. But as you get close to the speed of light, time slows down for you. Now, I know you're scratching your heads. Don't feel bad. In 1905, he writes his paper. He still can't get a job. He still can't get a job teaching high school. He doesn't. Nobody quite notices. But he has upended all of physics with this paper written in the miracle year of 1905, saying that the speed of light is always constant, but people in different states of motion will experience time differently. And it comes from just what is simultaneity. Anyway, that year, that 1905 miracle year, he not only does that paper, he looks at an equation that Max Planck has written. The physics students will know it, Planck's constant. Planck's constant, Max Planck thought it was just some mathematical contrivance he put into an equation to explain how radiation comes off of a piece of metal or something. Einstein looks at it and says, no, that means light's a particle as well as a wave. Once again, a creative leap of the imagination that light can be both wave and particle. He does a couple of other papers, and then finally, looking at his paper on special relativity, says, if all these papers are right, here's an addendum to my special relativity paper. He sends it in. It means there's a relationship between energy and mass that involves the speed of light. And so he comes up with the most famous equation in all of science, E equals mc squared. Total miracle year, but it totally baffles the physics establishment, who are not quite as creative as he is in Europe. Helping him do these papers is a truly amazing woman, a woman named Mileva Maritz. Mileva Maritz was a physics student, a girl growing up in Serbia, back in the times when it was hard for young women to be physics students. But her father is an army officer and gets her accepted to the all-male Zagreb Academy to study physics. And eventually she becomes the only woman in the Zurich Polytech class with Albert Einstein. And as you might suspect, they fall madly in love. The papers have been under seal, actually. The biography I've written deals with these papers that have just finally been released in the past year, because they were so passionate and so personal about pillows on fire and everything else. As students, they go to Lake Como. Many of you know Lake Como in northern Italy. Hike around Lake Como in April as the snow is melting with their blankets. She gets pregnant. They have an illegitimate daughter. I mean, it is a very passionate relationship. But they can't get married because he, at that point, doesn't have a job. The very week he gets a job in the patent office, he marries her. They have two sons. She helps with the 1905 papers, but it is a tumultuous marriage. And one of the things you learn as a biographer, whether it's of Franklin or Einstein or anybody else, is these are flesh and blood human beings. These are people who are not posters or statues, but people who have the same flaws. As my wife says, why do you keep writing about people who are so bad to their first wives or something? Don't worry, I'm no Einstein, I'm no Franklin. Anyway, Einstein finally decides, as a marriage falls apart, he needs a divorce, but he has no money. So he says to her, eventually, one of these days, one of those papers will win the Nobel Prize. If you give me a divorce, I will give you the money. She's a scientist. She's very smart. She spends a week. She calculates the odds and accepts it, takes the bet. By the way, don't try this at home. It doesn't work for everybody. It's not until you're scratching your heads about, you know, what time slows down stuff. If you feel bad, make you feel better. It's not until 1922 that they announce a Nobel Prize for this guy. 17 years after the papers were written. But she gets the money and she buys 3 apartment buildings in Zurich. So it's really good for her. In the meantime, Einstein has finally gotten a job at the University of Berlin right as World War I is breaking out. And the thing about Einstein's creativity and willingness to defy convention and authority is you see it in the politics as well. All the professors at the University of Berlin sign on to the manifesto supporting German militarism in World War I, as World War I breaks out. Einstein is a lone pacifist, anti-militarist, anti-nationalist, starts what's called the War Resisters League, which, by the way, is very hard to do in Germany in 1914. There's a struggle, the marriage, the divorce, the custody battles, going back and forth with the thing. He's having trouble getting food because the war has broken out. And in the meantime, he is doing the most elegant theory in the history of science, the general theory of relativity. And this is where you just see the human struggle and all of it happening as he's there in his garret doing it. Now, the general theory is called the general theory because the special theory of relativity, which I mentioned about time slowing down, deals only with constant velocity motion. Einstein doesn't like anything that's not generalized. He wants it to deal with all motion. Secondly, he's overthrown the pillars of everything Newton said is absolute. No absolute time, no absolute space. Newton, in the second book of the Principia, says time marches along second by second, irrespective of anybody observing it. And Einstein says, no, we don't know that. That's not true. It's different for different people observing it in different states of motion. But the one thing he has not overthrown is Newton's theory of gravity, which simply says that gravity is an attraction between two objects. Instantly, at a distance, the sun attracting the earth attracting the moon, instantly at a distance for no apparent reason. Einstein said that makes no sense. Nothing can happen instantly at a distance. Nothing can happen faster than the speed of light. No information can travel faster than the speed of light. So he tries to come up with a general theory, and he does it once again creatively. This is not somebody sitting there in the lab crunching the numbers and formulas. He's sitting there by himself imagining things and doing thought experiments. He says, what would it be like to be in an enclosed chamber on the surface of the Earth with gravity? For example, what would it be like to be in an elevator car with no windows? You're on the surface of the Earth. What would you feel? Well, you'd feel your feet being pressed to the floor, right? Just like now. You take something out of your pocket and you drop it. It falls to the floor at an accelerated rate. Now he says, imagine being in that enclosed chamber deep in outer space where there is no gravity. But imagine the chamber is accelerating upward. What would you feel? Well, you'd feel, think about it, accelerating upward with no gravity. Your feet would be pressed to the floor. You take something out of your pocket and let go, it would look like it's falling to the floor at an accelerated rate. He calls it the principle of equivalence. It's equivalent. All the effects of gravity are equivalent to all the effects of acceleration. Now, this is something they should have figured out. This is something Galileo should have figured out at the Leaning Tower. You know, we learn in high school physics that inertial mass is always equal to gravitational mass. The amount of force it takes to accelerate an object is always equal to the weight it would have in a gravitational field. But nobody knew why until Einstein said, it's simple, because acceleration and gravity are equivalent. And he said, it means that gravity is not some distant force acting between two objects, but it's simply an object curving the fabric of space. Once again, he does it imaginatively through a thought experiment so we can see it. He says, imagine a two-dimensional fabric. Imagine, say, a trampoline surface, a trampoline fabric in your backyard. You put a bowling ball on it and you roll it slowly along. What happens? It curves the fabric of the trampoline. And then you roll some billiard balls after it. They start rolling and they start curving to the bowling ball. Why? Not because the bowling ball's got some mysterious attraction at a distance, but because the fabric is curved and they roll down towards it. You and I can picture that. If you're Einstein, you can picture it happening in three dimensions. An object curves all three dimensions of space. And if you're really Einstein, you can imagine it happening in four dimensions, because what he's told us is that space and time are part of the same fabric, the four dimensions of space-time. So he says gravity is just the curving of the four dimensions of space-time. Now, I had you all nodding on the trampoline, and now by the time I got to the four dimensions, you all are... But that's a great thing about Einstein. You say, wow, and then you say, huh, and then you say, wow. And if it makes you feel better, once again, as I told you, this is in 1915. He doesn't win the Nobel Prize until 1922. So there are a lot of greater minds than perhaps ours, physicists all over Europe going, what? In fact, what's also happening is anti-Semitism is rising in Germany. And they start labeling this Jewish science because it doesn't bear any relation to reality. It's all theoretical and stuff. So Einstein says, okay, I'll bear some relation to reality for you. If I am right, if energy has mass, and if there's a curving of the space and stuff, it means that gravity will curve a light beam. In fact, if you the light from a star, as it passes right next to the sun, in the sun's gravitational field, he does a calculation, say, it'll curve 1.7 arc seconds. The problem is, you can't look at the stars right behind the sun, because the sun gets in your eyes. So, as World War I is ending, a pacifist Englishman, Quaker, decides to try to prove the theory of a German pacifist Jew by sending an expedition out to the total eclipse of the sun for the 3 minutes during the total eclipse in which you can see the stars right behind the sun. Off the coast of Africa and Brazil, they take photographs during those 3 minutes. Sir Arthur Eddington, the great British astronomer. And they bring all the plates back to London. It takes 4 months to get the plates back, to compare them, to look at it. And they call a meeting of the Royal Society in London. And people come from all over England. Bertrand Russell comes down from Cambridge. And Sir Arthur Eddington starts the meeting by pointing to the portrait of the founder of the Royal Society and saying, "Forgive us, Sir Isaac Newton. Your universe has been overturned." This is Einstein is back in Berlin. He gets a telegram. He shows it to a graduate student. She says, "You must be thrilled." He said, "No, I was confident." And she says, "Well, what would you have thought if it had turned out the other way?" He says, "I would have felt sorry for the good Lord because the theory is correct." This was in the days when the New York Times knew how to write great headlines. It was a long time ago, you know, New York Times, when it really knew how to write headlines and stuff and cover things. But they covered this meeting of the Royal Society. You'll be happy to know they didn't have a science correspondent in England, so they sent Henry Crouch. Some of you may know who he is. He was very famous. He was the golfing correspondent for the New York Times over to cover St. Andrews. He has to ask Eddington to explain it 3 times, but suddenly Einstein becomes the most famous person in the world. This is the New York Times headline, "Lights All Askew in the Heavens." I love this headline. "Men of science more or less agog over results of eclipse observation. Einstein theory triumphs. Stars not where they seemed or were calculated to be, but nobody need worry." Anyway, it's a great headline. So Einstein has suddenly become the most famous person in the world. But something interesting happens to him. First of all, he becomes more involved in world politics or stuff. He comes to America both to raise money for refugee Jewish scholars and Hebrew University. He is a superstar. I mean, visiting rock stars could only hope for the type of acclaim. They have parades for him wherever he goes. He arrives in the Battery with Chaim Weizmann, the head of the Zionist organization that's bringing him over. He arrives at the foot of the Battery in Manhattan. There are 15,000 people waiting because the newspapers and newsreels, you know, Einstein coming on. Weizmann gets off the boat first, by the way, and they ask him what they ask everybody who's ever been with Einstein, which is, "Do you understand the theory of relativity?" Weizmann says, "On the way over, Professor Einstein explained it to me many, many times. And by the time we got here, I was convinced that he understood it." They bring him to Washington, and only those of us who live in Washington can fathom this. But the Senate of the United States decides to debate whether relativity theory is correct or not. Senator John Rankin of Mississippi led the opposition. Senator Boyce Penrose of Pennsylvania was in favor of it and put it in the congressional record. They bring Einstein to see President Harding. They ask President Harding the question they ask everybody, which is, "Do you understand relativity?" This was a very long time ago, back when politicians were all honest. And so Harding says, "No." Einstein says it's not to worry, that he doesn't understand the theory of normalcy, which was Harding's political platform. But other interesting things happen to Einstein as well as he turns 50. And this is sort of the second part of my book, because it happens to all. I see a lot of people in this room, like me, who have turned 50. And he starts having questioned authority his entire life, having been the one that challenged every assumption. He starts defending classical physics as his quantum theory is transformed by a new generation of young Turks into something even more radical. Heisenberg has come up with the uncertainty principle, saying you can't know the position and momentum of a particle at any moment, that it depends on your observations of it. Something quite like Einstein would have come up with, as Heisenberg keeps pointing out to him. Niels Bohr comes up with the notion of probabilities and chance and all being at the heart of the subatomic realm. Einstein resists it. He says over and over again, "I cannot believe that God would play dice with the universe." At one point, finally, Niels Bohr says to him at the 1931 Solvay conference, "Einstein, please quit telling God what to do." And they say, you know, you used to be this way. And he says, yes, to punish me for my contempt for authority, the good Lord turned me into an authority myself. And so, and I think it happened, you know, we all kind of feel, you know, when we get to a certain state. People also asked him, you know, because he always said, I cannot believe that God or the good Lord or whatever. They thought he was using it as a figure of speech. But as he turns 50, he's much more reflective, much more religious. He surprises people in both secular Berlin in the late 1920s and then in the United States when he keeps saying, no, I am very religious and I believe in God. He said, I believe in a God whose spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe. It's a spirit in the face of which we must be humbled and awed. He did not believe in a personal God that you could actually pray to and have God break the laws of the universe and intervene in your lives or have the Dallas Cowboys win a game that they're losing if you pray hard enough. He said that for some people, miracles are evidence of God's existence. For me, it's the absence of miracles that show the harmonies of the universe and God's existence. He wrote a wonderful piece called, and I say this a lot because I look at other books out now and they're all trying to claim Einstein either as an atheist or a person of deep, you know, evangelical faith or whatever. And Einstein says, no, it's a question that's far too vast for our limited imaginations. We should be somewhat humbled when we try to do this. He says, science without faith is lame. And faith without science is blind. He said they can work together. And of course, it doesn't exactly appeal to people on either, you know, strong ends who think they're absolutely sure about God and stuff. At one point, a cardinal in Boston preaches a sermon and says it still smacks of atheism because he doesn't believe in an intercessional God who will intercede in our lives. At which point, Rabbi Goldstein, the head of the Reform movement in New York, sends Einstein a telegram saying, Einstein, do you or do you not believe in God? Answer 50 words or less. Answer paid. And Einstein doesn't use up the 50 words. He says, I believe in Spinoza's God, a God who's manifest in all the harmonies of the universe. And it probably didn't quite appeal to the rabbi or quite appeal to satisfy all the cardinals or whatever. But it does, I think, you know, most of us, as we grapple with more eternal questions than just the questions of relativity, we can understand a person like Einstein trying to grapple with that. And I found that very interesting. And to get to a place, actually a place where my old friend Benjamin Franklin got to, sort of a deist concept of the Creator. He also has been a ardent pacifist, as I said, since his Berlin days. But unlike some people in both parties and all over this country, he realizes that your general theories should be correlated with factual evidence. And so when the evidence changes, he changes his theories. He's very open-minded in the notion of a scientist. So when Hitler takes power, he immediately abandons his pacifism and says, I would join the army to fight Hitler. Sometimes you have to struggle both against Stalinism and then Nazism and then Stalinism. He changes his beliefs. He even writes, he immigrates to the United States and writes a letter to Franklin Roosevelt that's saying, based on E equals MC squared, that his friends have come up with the notion of a controlled nuclear chain reaction. He said this could lead to the construction of bombs. Suggests that America needs to have an atomic bomb project. And Franklin Roosevelt says this demands action and starts a Manhattan Project. And so, really, for the rest of his life, Einstein has lives under that burden after the bomb is dropped. Time magazine has him on the cover the week the bomb is dropped with the mushroom cloud, and on the mushroom cloud it says E equals MC squared. So he also then devotes himself not to pacifism again, because he's revised his theories, but to the notion of nuclear arms control and the notion of world peace, of trying to rise above nationalist antagonisms in an atomic age. They ask him at one point, because they call him naive, they say, well, how do you think World War III will be fought? He says, I don't know, but I do know how World War IV will be fought with sticks and rocks if we're not careful. And so he signs a Bertrand Russell, Albert Einstein Manifesto for World Peace. And even on his deathbed in Princeton, he's still trying to create the conditions for world peace and also doing the other thing he cared most about, which was his science, trying to overcome the uncertainties of the universe with the unified field theory he was working on. And even at the last day, he's hemorrhaging because he had an aneurysm and it burst. He decides to decline having an operation. He knows his time has come. But as he lies there in the bed, he reaches over and starts writing a speech, saying, "I speak," which was about world peace. It was supposed to be for Israel Independence Day, he says, but he decided to make it larger and about the need for world peace. He said, "I speak to you today, not just as a Jew and not just as an American citizen, but as a human being." And then the pain becomes so great, he puts it aside. But a few minutes later, he reaches to the nightside table again, and this time he pulls a sheet of paper there and just starts continuing a whole thing of equations that he had been working on before. For 20 years, he'd been working on the unified field theory. He knew he was dying, but he still wanted to write one last set of equations. And I went and just saw it at the Einstein Archives, just touching it. It's so moving. And you see equation after equation crossed out. I have it in the book, a picture of it. Making mathematical mistakes and arithmetic mistakes, even crossing them out and fixing it until it finally... it dribbles off as he writes one last line of equations that he hoped would get himself and the rest of us just one step closer to the spirit manifest in the laws of the universe. And so that's how a very impertinent, rebellious, slow-learning, but unbelievably creative third-class patent clerk became the mind reader of the creator of our cosmos and the locksmith in the mysteries of the atom and the universe. Thank you all very much.
We have time for some questions, and we start with a couple of questions from our friends from St. Mark's. Here's question number one, Paul Okelman. Hope I said that right. Describe the moment when the light bulb went on and you made up your mind, I'm going to write a biography of Einstein.
All right. First of all, as a biographer, the first thing you discover about all of your subjects is it's sort of about Dad. Whether it's Benjamin Franklin or Henry Kissinger living up to your father. Then the second thing you discover is, as a biographer, it's partly about Dad. And my father loved Einstein. My father was an engineer. My father loved math. And so I think I always, and this is why it's a good Father's Day gift. I'll sign it for your father. But I wrote it partly because my father always made me look up to the creativity and imagination of Einstein. So when I became... junior editor at Time Magazine in the early 1990s, my friends and I started to debate who should be the man or woman of the century. And Jim Kelly, a friend of mine, kept insisting it should be Churchill, and Rick Stengel was for Franklin Roosevelt, and somebody else was for Gandhi. And I kept saying, it's got to be Einstein, that his fingerprints are on everything that makes this century great. Everything from its technology to its science, and even to the notion of people fleeing oppression and coming to lands of freedom. His life is a testament to the connection between freedom and creativity. Well, luckily, I got to be the editor, and they didn't, and Einstein got to be the person of the century. And I flew over to Cambridge to get Stephen Hawking to write the cover story called A Brief History of Relativity. It's, if I may say so, a very good cover story, although you don't edit Stephen Hawking, so I don't take any credit for it. But I wrote the, because his piece was more scientific, I wrote the other part of the cover story, which is Why Einstein. And that was the moment when I was sitting there in December of 1999, secretly, because everybody thought we were picking Franklin Roosevelt, and I was trying to keep it secret, writing a cover story called Why Einstein. And I looked, and, you know, there are wonderful science books about Einstein, some older biographies, but not, and all these papers that were under seal that I was being given access to. And I said, why Einstein? Well, that was my answer. I was going to do Einstein.
Now, here's a great one from Robert Wood from St. Mark's. To what extent did Einstein's obsession with the universe and theoretical thinking interfere with his relationships involving others?
Yeah. Well, his first wife sure thought it did. She actually, one of the letters I said is something that you've probably seen written to your friends or whatever, which is, you know, he's married to his science, not to me, as Maleva writes to one of her friends. Einstein could compartmentalize. I mean, in that period of 1915 where he's doing general relativity and fighting the custody battle after the divorce and all that sort of thing, you can just see day by day things happening. He's racing with a mathematician named David Hilbert who's trying to come up with the field equations first. His wife is using, I don't mean to blame it on her. The kids are becoming pawns in the battle between them. And at one point, Hans Albert, the oldest son, this is the second week of November 1915, writes a letter that I sort of think that Mileva, the mother, encouraged him to write. He's only 11. It says, "Mom says that you're more interested in your science than you are in us, and so you're not going to come down to Zurich and visit us." This is when he's in Berlin. The war's broken out. It's hard to get to Switzerland, but he would hope to get there for Christmas. And said, "So she's tried to make us happy by buying me a set of skis, but they cost 70 francs, and she said I had to tell you to pay for them." I mean, you think, wow, you know, this is like the greatest person in the world, and he's still involved in the things you and I might be involved in. And he writes a letter back that morning saying, "This is, you know, an outrageous luxury. I will send you money, but I'm not going to pay for these skis." And writes a letter to Mileva saying, "How can you be using the kids?" Then feels very guilty and writes a letter saying, "I'm coming right after the new year." And that very day, he's writing the lecture. He's doing four lectures at the Prussian Academy. He hasn't figured out the field equations of general relativity, but he's halfway there, and there every Thursday he's giving the lectures, and he's working on them, even and calculating one of the ways to test his gravity. You all would understand this. You know, the perihelion of Mercury, the orbit of Mercury as it goes around the sun, there's some unexplained little thing. It's slightly off-kilter, that orbit. Nobody could figure out what it was. They thought maybe some planet that we hadn't discovered was tugging at it. And Einstein's calculating his field equations and realizing they explain why the orbit of Mercury is off-kilter. All this is happening at the same day, and he's compartmentalizing all of this. But obviously, his equations do get in the way of his personal relationships. After 1915, and especially after, say, 1922, when he wins the Nobel Prize, his science, as I say, becomes more defensive. He's no longer at the forefront of science, and he really mellows, and he becomes a great, wonderful humanist that we all know and love. He marries his cousin Elsa, who had taken care of him during the war, but he becomes friendly again with Mileva, and even those three apartment buildings I told you, when he comes to visit Zurich, he stays with her, you know, so they have a good enough relationship. His son, Hans Albert, the one who he had fought with over the skis, immigrates to America with him. So, like a lot of people, I mean, it's people say, "Gosh, that's so amazing." I say, "No, have we ever known anybody who tried to balance work and family and sometimes got it right and sometimes got it wrong?" That's the amazing thing about him.
Walter, the book obviously has a tremendous amount of physics in it, and you've obviously mastered it, as evidenced by the people on the back of your dust jacket. But how much physics did you know before you started writing this biography?
I liked science. I was one of those geeks who always entered the Westinghouse or now Intel Science Fair, but I was also somebody who always lost, so I was not a great scientist. And what happens to many of us in this room is we take one of two paths. We either become scientists or, like me, become historians. We're interested in the humanities. And we feel intimidated by science. And I really don't like that. I think that we're not intimidated by Shakespeare, which is pretty complex. We may not understand whether Hamlet loves Ophelia or not, or what the force field between them is, but we can still appreciate it. And so we'd never say, "Gee, I'm intimidated by Shakespeare. I can never like Shakespeare." But we'd say, "I'm intimidated by science. I'm intimidated by physics. I don't like physics. I can't do physics." And so I never wanted to be that way, and I don't think we should. I don't think we're going to have kids like, you know, students here at this room who are going to excel creatively in science and math if we keep hammering into them that, "Oh, I can't do it. I'm intimidated by it." But, you know, the teacher should force feed it to you. So I wanted to reengage with that sense of wonder that we all have as kids about the needle pointing north and the apple falling from the tree and why is the sky blue. And so I love doing it. This is not a science book. If you want a science book on Einstein, even though there is how his mind made these leaps, but if you want to read all the equations, you're going to have to go to other books. That said, it's something where I think it's no harder than Benjamin Franklin, people should try to enjoy the wonders of science just like I do.
Now, I would say when you have a New York Times best-selling author who's written about Ben Franklin, the man of the 18th century, and Albert Einstein, the man of the 20th century, you say, what's next? And early in your book, you make mention of Thomas Edison. Is that next or what's next?
No, I don't know, and I'm open for suggestions, but it won't be Thomas Edison. He's not a good guy. And I don't like writing about people who aren't good guys. In fact, if it's anybody, it'd be Nikola Tesla, who some of you may know, who is the actual inventor who understands electricity, alternating current, motors, lights, and Edison steals all of his patents and things. But I like people whose basic creative goodness also translates in the end to a good soul. And with all due respect to Edison, he doesn't appeal to me. But I'll find some... And I want to write about people who are inspiring and appealing, so I'll find somebody like that.
Anybody have any questions?
Yes.
31, yes. That's when the EPR paradox was brought forward. It was presented as a paradox, but eventually it turned around, was a prediction of what really was.
I know.
Did Einstein, or during his lifetime, when was it really realized that it wasn't a paradox, but a prediction?
Oh, real quickly, EPR is the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper that Einstein writes to basically try to disprove the uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics, saying if all this is true, what Heisenberg is saying, you know, this contradictory thing would happen. He calls it spooky action at distance, that observing one particle will actually affect a particle a zillion miles away or something. And that's obviously untrue, Einstein says, so quantum mechanics is incomplete. That's a very rough explanation, but you're not shaking your head, so I think I've gotten it close enough for this room what that paradox is. Spooky action at a distance comes from that paper. Well, you know, lo and behold, they keep doing the experiments over and over again, and they prove the weirdness and the spookiness of quantum mechanics turns out to be right. Einstein, by 1955, when he's, you know, dies, there have been enough experiments showing that quantum mechanics is not incorrect. That is basically correct. They haven't done Alan Aspect and everybody else comes later, but they basically know that all this spookiness of quantum mechanics turns out to be right. Einstein quit saying that quantum mechanics is wrong, but he just says it's incomplete. He says that there's got to be a more complete theory, and that's why he tries to do the unified field theory. He, at his core, didn't believe that the good Lord, I mean, he kept saying it, that God would not allow things to happen randomly by chance uncertainty, and that there was a reality. He was a realist. A reality exists independent of our observations of it. And as I said, the other young Turks say, wait a minute, you didn't say that when you were doing special relativity. And he would say things like, yes, but a good trick pony should only be used once or something, I mean, or whatever. So he does resist it to the end of his life, even though he knows the experiments are sort of right. Yes, ma'am. He stopped at three children. Well, as far as we know, I mean, he had other lovers and people. Actually, people come forward saying they're Einstein's mysterious child or something. You have to read the book to find out, because it's complicated, what happens to Lazurl, the illegitimate daughter, one of history's mysteries. She's put up for adoption in Serbia, and I go into the various theories and some conclusions about what happened to her. Edward, the younger boy, unfortunately, like his mother, who I very melancholy, succumbs to schizophrenia, ends up in a mental institution in Zurich. Hans Albert immigrates over to the United States with Einstein, or right after Einstein. They very much reconcile. He becomes a professor of hydraulics and at Berkeley, among other places, and had three children, and they have children, and their various Einstein descendants living in Southern California.
As I think you know, when our program's over here in a minute, Mr. Isis is going to be over here there to sign books for Father's Day and anything else. As far as the World Affairs Council goes, one of our focus obviously is on history, and there's a great quote by Einstein in the book, who says, in teaching history, there should be an extensive discussion of the personalities who benefited mankind through the independence of their character and judgment. And that's what we've had today. So thank you, Walter. Thank Fabulous you, use of history.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.